scribbling down the conversation as fast as he could. Alek felt his blood boiling. Like most Russians, Alek was certain of Zakhaev's guilt, so certain, in fact, that it did not even occur to the young lawyer that no actual facts were being presented. No actual evidence was being offered by the head of the Russian Security Service. Only later would he realize that there was no discussion of incriminating fingerprints found at the scene, or intercepted communications between the Chechen warlord and the men who had carried out these attacks. Nothing was being said about wiretaps or recorded conversations with Zakhaev, or even a single Chechen informant implicating him in these crimes. Luganov turned back to his defense minister.
Are your forces ready to move?
At your command, sir,
Petrovsky replied. Alek again looked up from his notes. He watched as his future father-in-law signaled his consent, then signed the orders as acting president. The second Russian invasion of Chechnya was about to begin. 8. At 5 minutes before noon, Zakharov summoned Alek. Together, the two men entered Luganov's office. It had been hastily transformed into a television studio. Bright, hot lights. Two broadcast-quality video cameras. A teleprompter. A boom microphone. And thick black cables, taped down to the carpet, threading everywhere like a pit of snakes. The chief of staff whispered to Alek to again take notes of everything he saw and heard. This was his sole responsibility for the time being. He was the official note-taker and secretary of the Prime Minister's private meetings and public appearances. He was supposed to record the name of everyone in a meeting and everything that was said, make careful note of any action items that were decided upon, and then type up all the notes and provide copies to the PM, chief of staff, and a short list of other senior staff within 24 hours for their review. Alek had no idea how long the assignment would last, or when his legal training might be tapped. For now, this suited him well. Alek wasn't supposed to speak during the proceedings, nor did he want to. He was sworn to secrecy about every meeting, but that was fine, as he had no desire to divulge anything sensitive, even to his fiancée. For her part, Marina was just thrilled Alek had the job. She had no interest in prying into her father's business. What's more, Alek told himself, the job was not difficult. Yet it put him in direct proximity with Luganov and all of his top advisors. It would allow him to learn about the man, his leadership style, and the nation he served. It was, in short, the opportunity of a lifetime. The side door leading to the conference room opened. Alek could see Luganov conferring with Petrovsky and Nimkov. Then Luganov nodded curtly and entered with his chief bodyguard, a man named Pavel, who shut the door behind them. Luganov took a seat behind his executive desk. He made a final review of the papers before him, marking them at times with a fountain pen he drew from his suit pocket. Alek wondered what it must feel like to have the weight of the nation on one's shoulders. The official occupant of the office, the man who had served as the president of Russia for 8 challenge-filled, exhausting years, was not well. Certainly the responsibilities had taken a heavy toll on the man physically and mentally. So had excessive drinking. If everything went as planned, the man would be out of office by the end of the year. In Alek's judgment, he had already stayed too long. Zakharov called for silence, and the last-minute whispering of the crew ceased immediately. The director gave a countdown, and suddenly the red light atop the central camera lit up. Luganov looked up from the pages and directly into the camera. It was the first time Alek could recall Luganov ever addressing the nation.
Citizens of Russia, our dear leader, as you know, is ill and incapacitated. He is receiving excellent medical care, and I ask you to pray for his quick recovery and for comfort for his family. But I must come to you today in my role both as Prime Minister and as Acting President to inform you that our nation is under attack. Let me assure you, the terrorist forces responsible for these heinous crimes against the Russian people will pay a great price. Under the authority vested in me by the Constitution, and the responsibility I have before God and the nation, I have ordered our air and ground forces into battle to defend our honor. Our forces will hunt down the enemy. We will chase them to the ends of the earth. We will eradicate them completely. Our forces will show no mercy, nor will I. On this, you have my word. The carpet bombing of Grozny began minutes later. 9. Ryazan, Russia, September 22, 1999. Sergeant Major Ilya Daskin drew his pistol and crouched in the shadows. The 59-year-old police officer motioned for his partner, a young trainee named Dima, to draw his weapon as well, and cover him as he entered the apartment building on Novoselov Street. Dima did as he was told, but even in the darkness, Daskin could see the kid's hands were shaking. Besides his service in the military, Daskin had been on the force all of his adult life. He'd been born and raised in this city, Ryazan, as had his parents and both sets of grandparents before him. In May of the coming year, he was due to retire. Dima, on the other hand, was all of 24. He had been on the force for less than 2 months, which was probably why he'd been sent from the academy to Ryazan in the first place. Located 200 kilometers from Moscow, the city was not of insignificant size. More than 500,000 people resided there. But it was far off the beaten path. Nothing interesting ever happened in Ryazan, certainly nothing dangerous. Crime was low. Drug trafficking was minimal. Tourism was almost non-existent. It was, apparently, the perfect city to send a rookie to train, at least according to those far up the food chain. Daskin couldn't have disagreed more. In his view, new cops should be sent to the toughest beats in the most crime-ridden cities. That's how they would learn the ropes, not out here in the sticks. He wiped his brow with his sleeve and moved through the vestibule of the apartment building, sweeping his weapon from side to side. The entrance was poorly lit, but Daskin was confident no one was there. He did, however, notice that the service door to the basement stairwell was ajar. He gripped the pistol tighter and inched toward the door. The building seemed unnaturally quiet for an autumn evening. Where were all the children? Why weren't they out playing in the courtyard? Where were all the young couples? Usually in a neighborhood like this, they'd be strolling in the moonlight, as would the retirees walking their dogs, and packs of teenagers heading to the mall. Ever since the bombings across the country, the streets had been quieter, to be sure. Many were too scared to sleep at night, terrified their building might be next to be blown to smithereens. But they were simultaneously scared to be out, fearing the terrorists were hatching new plots, especially now that the massive and unrelenting bombing of Chechen strongholds was underway. Daskin eased the basement door open with his foot. Holding his weapon in his right hand, he quietly drew his flashlight with his left hand and clicked it on. Then he pivoted into the stairwell, pointing both the flashlight and the barrel of his sidearm downward. He saw nothing, heard no one. This call, like so many others in recent weeks, was almost certainly another false alarm. The public was on edge.
People were overreacting, it seemed, to every strange sight, every unfamiliar person, as if Chechens were lurking in every shadow. The public wanted every noise to be checked out by the police, and Daskin knew he and his colleagues had no choice but to respond. People needed not simply to be protected. They needed to be reassured, even in Ryazan. Daskin flicked the light switch on the wall to his right and waited a few beats, listening for voices, for breathing, for movement of any kind. Hearing none, he clicked off the flashlight and slipped it back into the loop on his belt. Then, returning his left hand to the pistol, he slowly moved down the stairs, careful to set his feet at the far edge of each step to minimize the chance of the wood creaking from his weight. That was just the force of habit, of course. Anyone who might be hiding down there now knew full well he was coming. As he descended the stairs, Daskin could feel his heart pounding and sweat collecting on his face and neck and dripping down his back. He wondered if Dima was okay and began to second-guess himself. Had he been right to leave the young man watching the door rather than ordering him to come to the basement as well? Probably. If there was something to this call, which he highly doubted, but if there was, in fact, a shootout, which he doubted even more, Dima would be no help in such close quarters. Far better that he hear the gunshots and radio for backup than that he be caught in the crossfire. It had been less than 6 minutes since Daskin and his partner had received the radio call to check out suspicious activity at 14 Novosyolov Street. The dispatcher had just received a panicked call from a man calling himself Alexei, who said he lived in the building. Alexei told the dispatcher he had seen two suspicious men entering the basement. He added that a third person, possibly a woman, was waiting across the street in an idling white car. Like Daskin, the dispatcher hadn't been particularly worried, until the man mentioned, almost in passing, that the car was a white Lada, a four-door model. It was those details that had quickened the dispatcher's pulse, and now Daskin's. After all, such information had not been released to the public. But every police department in the country was looking for just such a car, after a witness had reported a similar vehicle at the site of the Gurianova Street bombing 2 weeks earlier. The sergeant major continued sweeping his weapon from side to side, moving slowly, steadily, cautiously, past the rows of cardboard boxes and piles of old furniture that cluttered his path. The place smelled of mold and cat urine. But Daskin kept pressing forward, and when he came around the next corner, his heart nearly stopped. For there, set under the massive furnace, was the first bomb he'd seen since his days as a sapper in the army. Daskin told himself to take a deep breath and make sure he truly understood the situation before radioing for help. He continued to search the basement, but finally convinced that no one else was there but him, he holstered his pistol, pulled out his flashlight, and got down on his hands and knees to examine the device more carefully. He could see several dozen sticks of what looked like TNT duct-taped together. Each was connected to the others by a series of black, red, and green wires. What he did not see was a remote detonation trigger, and this gave him a small measure of comfort. Had there been one, and if the terrorists were watching the building and had seen him go inside, they could have detonated the bomb immediately. But this did not appear to be the case. What Daskin did see, however, that he could not explain, were wires running from the sticks of TNT to what looked very much like three sacks of sugar. He had no idea what might be in the sacks, so he maneuvered around to the other side of the furnace and dropped to his stomach, trying to get as close to the odd contraption as he could. Only then did he find the detonator, connected to a timing device switched on, blinking furiously, and set for 5:30 a.m. Horrified, Doskin slowly backed away from the bomb. Getting to his feet and trying to steady his breathing, he called his partner and instructed him to start waking up everyone in the building and ordering them to evacuate immediately. Then he radioed headquarters to tell them what he'd found. Within minutes, sirens and flashing lights filled the night. Dozens of squad cars converged on Novoselov Street from all directions, followed by fire trucks and ambulances. Quickly thereafter, reporters and TV news crews arrived. As the police cleared the building and set up a perimeter to keep bystanders out of danger, the bomb squad arrived. Two specialists suited up and headed into the basement, while a half dozen more officers took bomb-sniffing dogs into the nearby buildings, just in case. The tension throughout the neighborhood was unbearable. The police were not giving out any information, but rumors were spreading like wildfire. As midnight approached, most of the people of Ryazan knew their quiet corner of Russia had been targeted for disaster. Eventually, two perspiration-soaked specialists reemerged from the building. They removed their bomb-proof suits and toweled off. Then they huddled with their police chief, the fire chief, and Doskin.
"It's done," said the lead bomb squad officer. "All clear."
"Why did it take so long?" the police chief asked.
"This one wasn't like anything we've seen before," the officer replied.
"Why not?"
"Several reasons. One was the detonator."
"What about it?"
"It wasn't your garden variety type. This thing was heavy-duty, combat quality. The kind of detonator we used to use in the Spetsnaz."
Doskin gave the officer an appraising look. If he had served as an explosive expert in Russian special forces, he clearly knew what he was talking about.
"How would terrorists get their hands on something like that?" the chief inquired.
"I have no idea. But there was something else very odd. Three sacks."
"Right. What were those?"
Doskin asked.
"Well, they sure weren't filled with sugar, I can promise you that."
"Then what?"
"We were stumped. So I told Misha here to bring me a portable gas analyzer."
"And?"
"Hexogen. Military grade. This thing would have leveled this building and maybe several more. Hundreds would have died. A real bloodbath. We're very lucky the sergeant major here found it in time."
The men stood silently, contemplating the gravity of the disaster they had just averted. Then, Doskin turned to his boss.
"Sir, with your permission, I think we should alert the FSB.
10. Had the police chief simply followed Ilya Doskin's advice, he might have lived. Instead, the chief called Vasily Malenchenko, the reporter for Novaya Gazeta, who was breaking one story after another about the bombings, for an exclusive over-the-phone interview. The chief told Malenchenko that he and his men had just foiled a major terrorist plot. In exacting detail, he explained how his men had discovered and defused an enormous bomb. He praised his officers, his bomb squad unit, and his detectives, while also detailing just how much devastation would have been wrought, given that the material was not the kind normal terrorists could get their hands on. No, he explained, meticulously describing the bomb itself, the detonator, the timer, the sticks of TNT, and the three mysterious sacks. This weapon was extra dangerous because it contained explosives produced specifically and exclusively for the Russian army. Malenchenko immediately jumped in a taxi and raced to the news studios of NTV, one of Russia's biggest television networks. Soon he was being interviewed on a live broadcast seen in all 11 of Russia's time zones. He didn't cite his sources, but he did relay everything he'd learned, including the part about the three sacks of explosives that, were produced specifically and exclusively for the Russian army, and effectively impossible for Chechen terrorists to get. Malenchenko's interview dominated the news cycle all day, as the recording was rebroadcast over and over again. The impact on the nation was immediate and catastrophic. All the fears the average Russian felt about a Chechen attack killing them and their children in their sleep were ratcheted up a thousandfold by the notion that the terrorists had access to the most advanced non-nuclear explosives in the Russian military's arsenal. Alek was up much of the night, chain-smoking, glued to the non-stop coverage, asking himself what everyone in Russia was asking. How in the world could Chechen terrorists have acquired military-grade bomb-making ingredients? Not once, but at least twice. Who inside the Russian army had given it to them? It couldn't have been enlisted men. It had to be officers, high-ranking officers. But why would high-ranking Russian army officers agree to help kill women and children in such a barbaric manner? How many such traitors were there? How had they not been noticed? Where would they strike next? How soon could they be caught? And in the meantime, who in the military and in law enforcement could really be trusted? These questions, and hundreds of others, quickly dominated the discussion in the media. Everyone had a theory, and each was more bizarre and scarier than the last. At just after 4:30 in the morning, Alek's secure phone rang. It was Zakharov's executive assistant. The chief of staff was ordering every member of the staff to get into the office immediately. When Alek arrived, the place was in crisis mode. The prime minister was coming by helicopter and would arrive at the Kremlin within the hour. Meanwhile, Zakharov was working the phones to manage the story, if not contain it. He had set himself up in the conference room. Generals, FSB officials, political aides, and public affairs officers were streaming in and out to provide updates and receive new directives, some of which were coming straight from the top. Initially, Alek's responsibility was to keep a written record of every fact, every instruction, every response and counter-response. But soon, the chief of staff directed Alek to answer incoming calls from Duma members and mayors and political bosses. People were calling from all over the country, demanding answers, and it was up to Alek to supply them. Zakharov gave him the script. First, Vasily Malenchenko was completely mistaken, Alek was instructed to say. There had never been a real terror threat in Ryazan. What the local police had stumbled over was a training exercise, organized by the FSB to simulate a possible bomb threat. The whole thing was a giant misunderstanding. The bomb looked real, but it was merely a prop. No one had ever been in real danger. Second, the three sacks of sugar did not contain military-grade explosives. They didn't contain explosives at all, and certainly not hexogen. The sacks actually did contain sugar. Again, the whole scene was set up to look like a terror plot, to test the instincts and reactions of local authorities and interagency cooperation with security officials in Moscow. But signals got crossed, and a series of miscommunications had occurred. Third, Malenchenko was a terrible journalist, a disgrace to the country, and should be fired immediately. If he was a loyal Russian and a good reporter, he would have done his job thoroughly and learned that this was simply a test. He could have cleared up the whole confusion rather quickly with just a few phone calls. Instead, Malenchenko had injected fear into a nation already rattled by the last several weeks of actual terror attacks by Chechen Islamists. He had gotten the story completely wrong, but now the citizens of Russia should carry on with daily life with the confidence that the military would crush the terrorists The FSB was doing a first-rate job protecting the country. Furthermore, the simulation had, in fact, been highly successful. No one was killed. No one was injured. The cops on the beat in Riazan performed well. So did the bomb squad and all the first responders. They all deserved medals. Malenchenko deserved Siberia. Alek dutifully delivered his message on dozens of calls, as Zakharov and other members of his staff did the same. Alek was relieved to learn the whole thing had been an FSB exercise, and he was honored and excited to be part of the rapid response team. That evening, he even got to be in the room as Prime Minister Luganov once again addressed the nation on live television. Luganov denounced Malenchenko by name while praising the police and first responders of Riazan. He encouraged the nation not to worry and provided an update on how many Chechen terrorists had been killed and how proud he was of the resolve of the Russian people in the face of such savagery and barbarism. National public opinion polls moved quickly and dramatically. By the end of that fateful week, Luganov's approval rating had shot up from a mere 4% to 21%. Images of Russian bombers devastating Chechnya filled the evening news. 2 weeks later, Chechen rebel leader Ramzan Zakayev was killed by a Russian sniper, and Luganov's approval ratings doubled to 45%. By the time the presidential elections were held later that fall, Luganov won in a landslide, capturing more than 63% of the vote. The Russian people were terrified no longer. The terrorists were dying in massive numbers. Not a single new attack had occurred on Russian soil. Luganov was being praised by presidents and prime ministers all over the world for being tough on terror. Alek Kraskin was ecstatic. He found himself an increasingly trusted member of the inner circle. What's more, he would soon be married and become a member of President Luganov's family. While driving home from the Kremlin several nights after the election, eager to meet Marina and take her to dinner and the ballet to celebrate, Alek heard an odd and disturbing story on the radio. The body of Vasily Malenchenko had been found in a dumpster on the outskirts of Moscow. The reporter had been shot in the back of the head, execution style. 4 days later, Alek read a small item buried deep inside Novaya Gazeta. The body of the Riazan chief of police had also been found in a parking garage in downtown Moscow. No one knew why the officer was in Moscow, the story noted. He had not been scheduled to visit the capital. He was actually scheduled for a minor surgical operation in Riazan the following morning. There were no suspects at this time, nor was there any known motive. But one thing was clear. The chief had not been mugged or set upon by a gang of youthful hooligans. He had been hog-tied. His throat had been slit. His tongue had been cut out. And his body was riddled with 23 bullets. Someone was sending a message. But who? And why? Part 2. 11. The Front Range, Colorado, May 19th, 2001. Marcus Riker tore north on Interstate 25 like a man possessed. Someone was going to die tonight, but it was not going to be him. Weaving in and out of traffic, racing up the shoulders on either side of the highway when he had no other choice, the 21-year-old rising college senior blew past the posted speed limit of 65 miles an hour. He was soon doing 80, 85, 90, 95. Yet he kept pushing the accelerator closer and closer to the floor and would not let up. Colorado Springs rapidly dissolved in the rearview mirror. The exit for Monument, population 2,000, was coming up fast, and the rusted maroon 78 Mustang he'd bought from his uncle was shaking violently. So was his girlfriend. Elena Marie Garcia had known Marcus since the sixth grade. They'd started dating in the 10th. No one knew his love of speed and risk-taking better than she. But this was insane.
"Marcus, for heaven's sake, slow down! You're going to get someone killed!"
Elena screamed as he veered around a sluggish oil tanker, a Greyhound bus, and two minivans clogging his way. She pleaded with him to calm down and tell her what had just happened, what in the world that phone call could possibly have been about. But she wasn't getting through, and for a moment she wondered if he could even hear her at all. Elena had never resisted, never even flinched at, much less criticized, any of his crazy adventures. Maybe she'd raised an eyebrow once or twice, but she was almost as much an adrenaline junkie as he was. Almost, though not quite. Coming from a staid and quiet home where nothing exciting or unexpected ever seemed to happen, she felt energized by Marcus's passion for life, and absolutely loved trying to keep up with him. He had, in fact, once confided to her that this was one of the reasons he had fallen in love with her in the first place. It wasn't just her warm brown eyes, her long jet-black hair, or her soft mocha skin. It was her zest for life. Together, they'd hiked more 14ers than she could remember, both in the blazing heat of summer and in the brutal Colorado winters. They'd skied some of the steepest mountains and the biggest moguls. They'd gone whitewater rafting through some of the most intense rapids in any river in any state within 200 miles of Monument. They'd taken flying lessons, and Marcus had earned his private pilot's license. They'd even taken skydiving lessons the summer after their junior year in high school, without their parents knowing, and laughed until they cried when they finally hit the ground alive and intact. But as Marcus screeched around corners and blew through red lights and stop signs, Elena burst into tears. She was grasping the door handle for dear life. But she had stopped trying to make sense of what had come over this man she loved. The evening had started off magically enough. Marcus had arrived at her house at precisely 5 o'clock to pick her up for a big fundraising banquet put on by the Air Force Academy to raise money for children of parents killed in action. It was being held at the Broadmoor, the swankiest hotel in the Springs, and they'd been given 2 free tickets. It was a great treat for the 2 college students, home and working hard for the summer. Marcus had looked handsome, decked out in a snazzy black rented tux. Given that they'd skipped their high school prom to go whitewater rafting with friends, it was the first time she remembered him wearing anything but jeans, a t-shirt, and Timberland boots. His wavy blonde hair was freshly trimmed. His rugged, chiseled face, the heritage of his Dutch roots, was freshly shaved. His blue eyes danced with anticipation of the evening ahead, and he had brought her a bouquet of dazzling red and blue and purple wildflowers that he had picked in the foothills. She'd loved that he had noticed and complimented not only her dress and shoes, but new pearl earrings and necklace, which she'd saved for and bought herself. She'd loved watching him banter with her bow-tie-wearing corporate lawyer father and her every hair in place, every syllable just so church organist mother. She'd loved how he'd listened to her giggling younger sisters like he had all the time in the world for them. They'd arrived at the Broadmoor, taken in the glamorous surroundings, and enjoyed the hors d'oeuvres being passed around by stewards. It was all going so well. And then, Marcus had taken an unexpected call on his cell phone, and the trajectory of the night took a sudden and devastating turn. Now the man she planned to marry once they both graduated from the University of Northern Colorado the following year turned the wheel hard to the right and went barreling around one more corner, tires squealing. Then they were on Marcus's street. They tore into his cul-de-sac, and when he slammed on the brakes and came screeching to a stop on the freshly mowed lawn of his childhood home, Elena silently thanked God for the seatbelt she was wearing, fully convinced that otherwise she would have been thrown through the windshield. Marcus immediately shut down the engine and pulled the keys out of the ignition. "Go next door, now," he told her. "Call 911, then call your father, and don't leave the Matthews house till this thing is over. Do you hear me?" With that, he threw open the door and bolted across the lawn.
"Till what's over?" she yelled after him. "What's wrong?"
Marcus didn't answer. Yet he didn't seem angry, not at her, at least. His voice had seemed surprisingly calm, given the way he'd been driving. But there was a sense of authority and urgency Elena had never seen or heard in him before. As he disappeared from view around the far side of the house, Elena just sat there for a moment, in shock. But then she heard the sounds coming from inside the house, and it began to dawn on her what was unfolding. She heard something glass smash against a wall. She heard pots and pans striking walls and countertops. The man who was now Marcus's stepfather was throwing things. She heard him shouting obscenities so loudly that fathers and mothers up and down the street were emerging from their doors to see what in the world was going on. Children were standing frozen in their yards, staring at the Riker house, unable to continue playing. A flash of fear rippled through Elena. She imagined Marcus's stepfather suddenly rushing out the front door and finding her, alone, in the rusty old Mustang in the middle of his finely manicured lawn. She needed to go. Now. Bursting out the passenger side door, she raced to the Matthews house in her ball gown and matching heels, and pounded on the front door. Mrs. Matthews was there, trembling and alone with her cats. But she knew Elena, and quickly pulled her inside, locking the door behind them both. The police had already been called, the woman assured her. But she handed over the phone, so Elena could call her father.
12. Don't die and don't get arrested. For years, that's what his mother had told him. She'd said it every time he left the house. She'd been saying it since he'd entered puberty. But now, as he raced to the backyard, adrenaline surging, Marcus knew full well that before the night was finished, it was going to be one or the other. Stripping off his tuxedo jacket and bow tie, he unbuttoned his collar, ripped the silk lining out of his jacket, then tore the lining into two long strips. As his stepfather's cursing grew all the louder and more vicious, Marcus wrapped the strips of fabric around his hands to protect them, then began scrambling up a wooden trellis covered with his mother's climbing roses, now in full bloom. Reaching the top, his hands scraped and bloodied from the thorns, though not nearly as badly as they could have been, Marcus pulled himself up onto the roof of the screened-in porch and moved toward the window of the master bedroom. Roger Duhame, the man who had terrorized their lives for the last 18 months, was pounding furiously on the bedroom door. He was demanding to be let in and threatening to get an axe and smash the door down if his wife didn't comply immediately. Marcus's mother was cowering in a corner, shaking uncontrollably. Her blouse was ripped and splattered with blood. Her nose appeared broken, and Marcus could see bruises and welts on her face and arms. As he scanned the room, he could see that the lock on the bedroom door was engaged, and that his mother had tried to push the heavy oak dresser against the door for extra protection, though she hadn't gotten it very far. Marcus rapped on the window. Startled, Marjorie Riker whipped around, fear in her eyes. She didn't move. She didn't say anything. She just gripped a cordless phone in her right hand. She shouldn't have been surprised to see her son on the roof. She had, after all, warned him not 20 minutes earlier not to come through the front door.
"He just snapped,"
she'd whispered to Marcus over the phone, the sense of urgency in her voice palpable.
I think he really means to do it this time.
She had apologized over and over again for interrupting his date, his special night, but Marcus would have none of it. He told her to lock herself in her bedroom, call the police, and wait for him to get home and take care of everything. That's when she had begged him not to come into the house, not to get into a confrontation with Roger.
Don't get in his face, Marcus. He'll kill you,
she'd warned him in no uncertain terms.
He's been drinking all day. He'll kill us both.
But Marcus had dismissed her warnings. He'd told her he was coming. He'd protect her. Everything would be okay. All he asked was that she unlock and open her bedroom window so he could get her out quickly when he arrived. Yet now that the moment had come, she seemed completely caught off guard. She just stared at him. She hadn't opened the window, nor had she unlocked it, nor was she about to. Instead, she was backing away from him, terror growing in her eyes. It occurred to Marcus that his mother couldn't see his face. The sun shining over the Rocky Mountains was illuminating him from behind, making just a silhouette.
Mom, it's me, Marcus. Open the window, he said.
But then came a chilling new sound. It was not that of an enraged man pounding on the bedroom door with his bare fists. It was that of an axe splintering the wood. Marcus couldn't wait any longer. He slipped off his polished black dress shoes, plunged one fist in each, and then, wearing the shoes like boxing gloves, punched his way through the window. For a moment, Roger stopped hacking at the door and demanded to know what was happening. But when his wife didn't respond, he started attacking the door all the more furiously. Marcus scraped the glass away from the window frame, then put his shoes back on, reached in, and unlocked the window. As he climbed inside, he immediately moved to his mother's side. Her eyes registered both the relief of seeing her son and the simultaneous fear that at any moment her husband would smash through that door and hack them both to death. Marcus knew he was running out of time. His mother would never make it across the roof and down the trellis. She was obviously in great pain after the beating she'd just taken, and he feared she could fall off the roof and break her back or neck. Not hearing any sirens yet, Marcus told her to go into the bathroom and lock the door. At first, she hesitated when he said he wasn't going to join her. But when he calmly insisted, even as the hole in the door grew, she complied. Splinters were flying through the room now. Marcus knew he had only seconds to act. He pushed the dresser in front of what was left of the door. Then he raced to his mother's closet and flicked on the overhead light. Stepping onto a small wooden stool, he pushed away a row of shoeboxes, feeling around until his hands brushed the cold metal barrel of a Remington 870 Wingmaster. The dusty 12-gauge pump-action shotgun was more than 30 years old. It had been his father's. His real father's. After his death, when Marcus was 11, his mother had planned to sell it or give it away, just as she'd done with many of his things. Marcus hadn't exactly begged, but he had made an impassioned and rather well-reasoned plea that the gun was a keepsake, a part of their family history, and that she should hold on to it until he was old enough to learn to hunt like his father and his grandfather before him. Impressed and surprised by his logic and articulateness at such a young age, she'd relented and tucked the gun away in her closet for safekeeping. Since then, she'd probably forgotten about it. But Marcus never had. Every few months growing up, he'd secretly snuck into his mother's room and checked to make sure the shotgun was still there, that she hadn't given it away. As Marcus scrambled to find ammunition, and amid the murderous rage and deafening vulgarities, he could finally hear sirens in the distance. The police were coming, but it was clear they weren't going to arrive in time. He continued working methodically through the cramped closet, shelf by shelf, drawer by drawer, until, in one of the shoeboxes, he finally heard what he needed. He ripped it open. Finding 5 shells, he quickly loaded 2, pumped, then turned and pulled his cell phone from his pocket. He dialed 911. When he heard the call connect and an operator's voice come on the line, he stepped back into the bedroom and tossed the phone onto the bed, just as Roger Duhame smashed through the door and shoved the dresser aside. Suddenly, Marcus was standing just a few feet away from a haggard, unshaven man in his late 50s. He wore a dirty pair of work jeans and a t-shirt stained with oil. His bare feet were tinged with the green of freshly cut grass. His filthy hands were shaking, and as he tightened his grip on the axe, he demanded Marcus put down the gun and tell him where his mother was. Marcus said nothing. He just stood there and locked eyes with his stepfather, holding the shotgun low at his hip, aimed at the man's chest. Duhame was soaked in sweat. His hair, what was left of it, was askew. His eyes were bloodshot and glaring with hatred, but also confusion. He scanned the room, looking for his wife, and not finding her. For a moment it seemed he was going to come at Marcus, but Marcus did not move, did not flinch, nor did he fire. He simply stood his ground and waited. Then Duhame heard Marjorie crying in the bathroom. The moment he did, his mouth broke out in a twisted smile. He glanced behind him and began to back up away from Marcus and toward the bathroom door.
"This isn't between you and me," he growled. "This is about your mother and me, and you'd best stay out of it."
Marcus remained motionless, but calmly and clearly, he told his stepfather to put down the axe, back out of the room, and leave the house, and no one would get hurt. The man just laughed. Marcus repeated the instructions and explained precisely what was going to happen if his stepfather did not put down the axe and leave the room and the house immediately. But his words had no effect. The man did not comply. His stepfather was swaying now, side to side. He was laughing. He raised the axe, mumbled something incomprehensible, and lunged at Marcus. Marcus didn't hesitate. He pulled the trigger, not once, but twice. 13. 2 shotgun blasts echoed through the neighborhood. Then all was quiet. Elena screamed as she burst out of the Matthews house, tears streaming down her face, and ran toward Marcus's front door. She was stopped by one of the police officers who had just pulled up. A half dozen squad cars filled the street, along with a SWAT vehicle and 2 ambulances. The chief of police was ordering his men to set up a perimeter around the house. Then he ordered all the neighbors back into their homes. Frantic to see if Marcus was okay, Elena insisted she be allowed into the house. The chief refused. Multiple gunshots had just been fired, and it was not clear by whom. Nor was it clear what might happen next. There was an active shooter in the house. The crime scene needed to be secured, and there was no way he was going to allow anyone into that house, no matter what her relation to the people inside. Mrs. Matthews came up behind Elena. She gently put her arm around the trembling young woman and coaxed her back into her house. She locked the door again, then put a sweater and a thick blanket around Elena. She made a pot of tea and brought a small tray of things to eat, but Elena had no appetite. Rather, she parked herself in the living room, staring out a bay window, riveted on the drama unfolding before her. Soon SWAT team members in full battle gear entered the front and the back doors of Marcus's mother's house, guns drawn. Elena tensed, terrified at what might happen next. Minutes later, more uniformed officers entered the front door, followed by men in plainclothes. Detectives, Elena thought. Sometime later, A team of paramedics entered with a stretcher. Mrs. Matthews turned on the television and flipped back and forth between the local channels, whose news crews were broadcasting live from the scene. One station reported that two hostages had been held inside the house until a police sharpshooter had taken out the alleged perpetrator. A different station cited a source in the police department and claimed someone in the house had committed suicide. A national cable news station said one person had been shot and killed. Another claimed two people had been shot and one was dead, while the second was severely wounded. Elena wasn't sure what to believe, but it was surreal to see photos of Marcus's family on the news. One of the networks eventually showed a photo of Roger Duhame. Elena knew Marcus's stepfather was an alcoholic. Marcus had begged his mother not to marry him. She'd done it anyway, and it had been a disaster. The man had abused her emotionally and physically, leading to not one, but two restraining orders. Both had been lifted. Marcus had pleaded with his mother to leave him, pleaded with his sisters to get her out of the state. The man was dangerous. He needed help. He certainly needed to be kept away from their family. But no one had listened. And now, here they were. Elena had never met Marcus's real father, but she'd heard all about him. Captain Lars Riker had been shot down by a surface-to-air missile on January 16, 1991, while flying an F-16C Fighting Falcon on a combat mission in southern Iraq during Operation Desert Storm. Marcus had been just 11 years old. Night fell. The street lamps came on. The police aimed floodlights at the house. Down the street, Elena could see the lights from all the TV cameras. Suddenly, the front door opened, and a stretcher emerged. One, not two. And on it was a body covered in a bloody sheet. Elena gasped. As the stretcher was loaded into the back of a waiting ambulance, Elena's hands began to shake. Her lips began to quiver. She was trying not to jump to any conclusions, but she'd had enough of all the speculations. She had to know the truth, however brutal. She jumped up from the couch and headed for the door. Mrs. Matthews tried to stop her, but Elena kept running. She crossed the freshly cut grass toward Marcus's house, just as the front door opened again. Elena stopped dead in her tracks. Two officers were coming out the door and down the driveway. Marcus was with them, his hands cuffed behind his back. 14. The steel doors slammed shut. It was now 2:46 in the morning. Marcus Johannes Riker had been read his legal rights by local sheriff's deputies. He'd been strip-searched, interrogated, booked, photographed, fingerprinted, and given an orange jumpsuit to wear. Now he found himself incarcerated in the El Paso County Criminal Justice Center. Some 1,500 inmates were housed in this complex. Some were waiting to be charged with a crime. Most were awaiting their court dates or their sentence and transferred to state or federal prisons for the long haul. Marcus wondered what his cellmate was in for. The guy was over 6.5 feet tall and must have weighed more than 250 pounds. Marcus took him for Samoan in origin, though he couldn't be sure. The man said nothing as Marcus entered the cell. He just lay motionless on the bottom bunk as Marcus climbed up to the top bunk. Marcus wasn't too worried. He was not a small man himself, despite his relative youth. At 6'1", he clocked in at 175 pounds and had been a star left guard on his high school football team all 4 years. He was in excellent physical shape and had never lost a fight. He hoped there wouldn't be any trouble tonight, but he was prepared to hold his own if it came to that. The cell block was as quiet as it was dark. Most of the inmates were asleep. Marcus lay on his back and stared at the ceiling just a few inches from his face. Soon enough, He could hear the man on the lower bunk snoring. He looked around. The space was simple enough. The concrete block walls were painted a light green. The metal frame bunk bed was bolted to the floor and the left wall. The mattress was thin. The pillow was small. The blanket was scratchy and too small to cover his entire body. Next to the bunk there was a metal toilet bowl. Beside it was a small stainless steel sink. The cell smelled like body odor and disinfectant. He could hear lots of men snoring. He could also hear guards making their rounds on a precise rotation, their boots clomping along the freshly mopped halls, keys jangling at their sides. The belly is an ungrateful wretch. It never remembers past favors. It always wants more tomorrow. The line was Solzhenitsyn's, from one of Marcus's favorite novels, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. It was a story of a hapless soul, falsely accused, and locked away in a Soviet gulag during the Second World War. Not once, since he first read it as a freshman in high school, had Marcus ever actually imagined being in prison. And never had the line rung so true as it did right now. Marcus's stomach was grumbling so loudly, he wondered if it could be heard up and down the corridor. He'd hardly eaten anything since breakfast. You should rejoice that you're in prison. Here you have time to think about your soul. Another line from the novel. Marcus chewed on the words as he pondered all that had happened in the span of just a few short hours. One thing was clear. He'd had no choice but to shoot. His stepfather had been coming at him with an axe. He didn't think he would have any regrets about his actions. But then he pictured his mother's face when she'd come out of the bathroom and found her second husband lying in a pool of his own blood. Marcus had expected to see relief in her eyes, gratitude even. He had, after all, saved her life. Instead, she'd collapsed to the floor in unspeakable grief. A second image that haunted him was that of Elena's face, the moment their eyes had met just before he'd been transported away from the scene in the back seat of one of the squad cars. He'd expected to see sympathy in those beautiful brown eyes. He'd seen something else instead. What was it? Fear? He couldn't say for sure, but it wasn't good. With these unsettling thoughts in his mind, he finally drifted off to sleep.
Riker, you have a visitor.
It was morning. Marcus felt peaceful and refreshed. He was eager to see Elena. The lock clicked open. Two guards accompanied him down the hall to a semi-private holding room. There he was ordered to sit on a chair in a small booth next to a bulletproof window and wait. After a few minutes, his visitor appeared. It was not Elena. It was her father. Marcus had told Elena to call her father the night before because he knew he'd need a lawyer, even if Mr. Garcia had zero experience in criminal law. Still, seeing him now reminded him this wasn't just about getting out of jail and clearing his name with the authorities. It was also about clearing his name with the Garcia family. He'd done nothing wrong, and he needed them to know that. Wearing a freshly pressed dark blue pinstriped suit and a crisp white dress shirt, Mr. Garcia, as stern-faced and dour as Marcus had ever seen him, sat down on the other side of the glass. He set a yellow legal pad on the counter, pulled a Mont Blanc pen from his breast pocket, and picked up the telephone receiver mounted on the wall. Marcus took a deep breath and picked up the receiver on his side as well.
First things first, Mr. Garcia said. These conversations are monitored. Remember that.
Okay.
Next, I just came from seeing your mother.
Mr. Garcia continued.
Good. How is she?
Marcus asked.
Well, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but she was hospitalized last night. I'm afraid she had a heart attack. It was a minor one. The doctors say she's going to be all right.